So yesterday we started talking about quantum phase transitions. So I remind you, we have a Hamiltonian that depends smoothly on a set of parameters G. And then a quantum phase transition is a particular point G such that when G approaches GC, some things can happen. So one thing that can happen is that there is a level crossing. And this means that the derivative of the energy of the ground state with respect to this parameter becomes discontinuous. Or this can be continuous, and then you can have an avoided level crossing, which means that some higher derivative, typically the second derivative, is discontinuous. So we also have seen that, so this is the case with which we are most interested in. Because this is the case in which we have critical phenomena, which means that the gap shrinks to zero as the G approaches the GC and in the thermodynamic limit in this way. So delta goes like some energy scale, G minus GC, zeta nu. So we have this set of critical indices that define our critical phenomenon. And psi to the minus one, which is the correlation length, the G minus GC to the nu. And then, of course, psi to the minus z is delta. Okay, so this is critical behavior. So I want to stress again that this phase transition has nothing to do with temperature. We are at T equals zero. And all we are concerned with is that the ground state, and this energy is the ground state energy. And the critical behavior depends because on the fluctuations that are obtained by drawing driving a parameter to some critical value. Okay. So today we'll study the quantum phase transition in the quantumizing model. So of course, so let me write again the Hamiltonian. So now I will write the coupling constants in this way in order to be consistent with the treatment of the exact solution that is given in the SUCHDEF book. So this is the Ising model, Ising chain, because it's the 1D model, equal one, in a transverse field G. Okay, so let's start to understand what does the ground state of this model look like in different limits of our in our parameter space of this coupling constant G. So of course, J just sets some energy scale, doesn't have any importance for the quantum phase transition. And we also argue that there must be some phase transition because at this point we don't know yet if there is one. Okay, so let's first examine the case where G is much greater than one. Okay, so that we can completely neglect the second term, the Ising term. So what does the ground state look like? So I will use this to cat 0 to indicate the ground state. Well, we minimize the energy by just choosing the eigenstate of eigenvalue plus 1, because we have this negative coupling for each of these operators sigma xi. So what is this? So this is the eigenstate of eigenvalue 1, and this just means up plus down. And the left one is with the minus as eigenvalue minus 1. So and we do it for every I, so then we all multiply them together. So this is a tensor product. Okay. So there is a, in many body theory, an abuse of notation. Sometimes people and myself too still write the symbol product when I am taking, in fact, the tensor product of different degrees of freedom in a Hilbert space, or the tensor product of operators acting on different Hilbert spaces. So this is an abuse of notation because it's, I don't know, just convenient when writing, but one really means the tensor product. Okay, so we notice immediately a couple of things, is that this ground state is first of all a product state. So it's not a superposition of different branches. Now in many body theory, when you make a superposition of different states, and you have many particles, unless you are doing something, I mean, very ad hoc, not being, so having a superposition will mean also that your state is entangled. So in this case, it is not entangled. It's a completely factorizable state. So this is for G much greater than 1. But now we can imagine that we do some perturbation theory around this point. So perturbation theory in 1 over G, which means basically that we are switching on a little term here. And so the perturbation theory will be done in the tutorial. But I want to show you what happens to correlation functions. Okay, so the correlation function of, say, sigma z at the site I, sigma z at the site j, in this state, so 0 for g going to infinity, well, is exactly 0, as you can easily see. When we do perturbation theory, this will not be 0, but it will have this behavior. It will fall off exponentially with the distance between I and j over some typical length that, in fact, this defines the correlation length. And we know how we can compute this. Well, you will do it in perturbation theory, and today we'll also see the exact solution. Well, we know that psi is related to delta, so we just need to compute the mass gap. Now, this feature of having exponentially decaying correlation functions when you have a mass gap is not just a property of the Ising model. So it is always true that if you have a mass gap, and which means that in particular the ground state is non-degenerate, because degeneracy can be seen as an absence of a gap between two states. Then to be precise, the connected correlation functions, I will explain this tomorrow. So they are just the correlation functions with respect to the background expectation value of these observables. They have to fall off exponentially. Now, this is a thing that has been known in many examples and also argued with several arguments for a very long time, so for like 50 years or so. But only very recently that has been produced, so in 2006 has been produced by Matthew Hastings a rigorous proof of this fact that if you have a gap, you have this behavior. And we will actually show it in one of the next lectures. And it is a consequence of the locality of the model, of the fact that our model is defined by the sum of local operators that act only on degrees of freedom that are nearby. But so we'll see that. Okay, so this is the limit g much greater than 1. So we have this behavior. So now let's see the other limit. So the limit where g is much smaller than 1. So in particular, when g is equal to 0, now our ground state for g equals 0, well, becomes degenerate. Because now to minimize this energy, I have two ways of doing that. I can place all the spins up, which again I can denote in this way. Or if I write just this, by this I mean the global all spins up state, or all spins down. So we see that we have at the quantum level also symmetry breaking. So in particular, what is the symmetry? So the Z2 symmetry of the Hamiltonian, Z2 symmetry breaking, the Z2 symmetry of the Hamiltonian is this operator T that is just the product of sigma x over all the sides. And so the Hamiltonian commutes with this operator. So it's our Z2 symmetry. But the ground state is not invariant under this symmetry. In fact, T on the global up doesn't go in itself, but goes in the other one. And again, the different symmetry broken states, as we saw in the classical case, are related by the symmetry operator. And in this case, there is nothing else. So there are no other states that are not related by the symmetry breaking. So what are the correlation functions here? Okay, so for instance, in the state all spins up, sigma z I, sigma z j up. Well, we see that this is equal actually 1 in this state, regardless of the distance between xi and xj. So also when this is very large. And so if we do perturbation theory, so if we now add a small g, of perturbation theory, this number will change a little bit and will start becoming smaller. It will become some number, let me call it m. Well, no, so such deficit uses n0 square. Let me use this thing, which is smaller than 1. and at least perturbatively in G, this is some number that is greater than zero. Okay, now if this ground state zero of G for every value of G, so not just for these small variations of G around these two limit points, if this were analytic, so an analytic function of G, there would be no way of connecting this correlation function that is exponentially falling off. So this is happening as we diminish G to this correlation function that is just some constant. So actually, this is not a constant, but so this also depends on G, this number, but as some polynomial behavior. So in fact, it's something that goes like this. So there is no way of doing that. So this means that the only possibility is that this state is not analytic. And this implies that also the some derivative of the ground state energy must be non-analytic. The reason being, so if I compute the first derivative of the ground state of the energy, this is like computing the derivative of H in my ground state. So what is this? This is equal to the derivative of the state, H 0 plus 0 H 0 plus 0 DH 0. Well, so if you differentiate then the normalization of the ground state, well, you see immediately that you get this, but this also must be zero because this is a constant. So these two terms are not there. So this means that a discontinuity in the energy can only come from a discontinuity in zero, because dH is always continuously differentiable, because our initial assumption is that HG is always smooth. Or, well, if you compute the second derivative, well, you will have is that you will have terms of this type. So it will mean that another possibility of having some non-analyticity is that instead of being this state discontinuous, it's its derivative that is discontinuous. And so this is what is happening here. However, there must be some non-analyticity in order to be to explain why these correlation functions change in this way. Okay, so there is some.
Polynomially? Or can you say again?
So it's some polynomial in G, it's not some polynomial in the distance between the spins.
Okay.
It's a constant in the distance between the spins, just a constant that depends on G. Okay. So there must be some critical value of G. So our task now is to understand what is this value. Okay, so this is the first thing that we would like to know. So there are three ways of doing it. So the first one is brute force.
means solve the model exactly. So now the one-dimensionalizing model is one of the few quantum many-body systems that you can exact solve. And we will do it today. So of course, when you solve it exactly, it's always very nice because you know everything. But we should also learn some other method, because this situation is pretty rare that you can solve exactly a quantum many-body model. Then there is the second approach that is the brutish approach. That is perturbation theory that you will do today in the tutorial. And then there is the elegant way. So this is the first thing that we see today. And so we must use some smart trick. So the smart trick that we use is the duality. So I will define what is a duality transformation and show you how you can use it to extract the position of the critical point without doing calculations. Okay, so the duality works like this. So the duality is a transformation on the lattice. So typically, we do a mapping between the sides of our lattice to the sides of some other lattice. And then we define some other degrees of freedom and find some other model. And we will say that two models are dual one to each other. So what we will do here is the following thing. So our lattice is a chain. And so this is labeled by I plus one, and so forth. Okay. So we will map the edges, the links of this lattice, to the sides of a new lattice. So this will be mapped to some site, the site, this edge will be mapped to another site that I will call M. This one to another site that I call M plus one, and so on and so forth. So you see that you obtain another chain. So I will map the site, the label I to the label M, but now M refers to somehow the whole edge. And now I have to define new variables mu on M. Okay? So I will define them in this way. So mu one on M, and I put a hat because we are doing a quantum model, so this must be operators. Well, it's just the in terms of the old variables, so it's acting here, right? So it must be something that refers to this edge. Well, I will just say, oh, it's my async coupling. So this at this point, this is very trivial. I have just renamed my async coupling up there with this variable here. Then let me define the second one that for some historical reasons is called mu three of mu. So this one is not very trivial. So what I do is that I take sigma x on the site that is immediately after M. So in this case, it's I plus one. And then make the product of all the spin operators from some reference point that is can be the first spin of the chain. So J here. So this is a string operator.
So to be concrete, mu 3 here is simply sigma x on this side on is sigma x on this side, sigma x on this side, up to here. It's the product of all the sigma x. So it's a non-local operator, right? Because it's a product of many spins that extends on arbitrarily large lengths. Sigma x, yes. Yeah, yeah. This is sigma x. Okay. Now we would like to understand if this chain in these variables, is it again a spin chain? So what makes our chain, our original chain, why do we say that it's a spin chain? Well, it's because these variables have some algebra, and in particular the algebra of the spin variables is the one such that sigma x sigma z is zero. So this is the anti-commutation, and sigma x square is equal to sigma z square is equal to the identity. So this means that you have a spin 1/2 variable. So we would like to check whether they obey the same algebra or not. Well, so it is obvious that, so this second property is obvious. So m1 square is equal to m3 square is equal to the identity, because these are just the products of sigma variables. So when you square them, you obtain the identity everywhere. And now we would like to see if mu1 at m and mu3 at m anti-commute. So this is what we are asking ourselves. Well, they do, because what are they? So what we have is that mu1 at m is sigma z on the spin I times sigma z on the spin I plus 1. So let me put z, z. I mean that I'm acting with sigma z. And then I have my, so this is mu1. But then if I had another color, never mind. Then I have a mu3. Mu3 is a string operator that arrives here. And it bears sigma x up to here. Okay, so, and this is the spin I. So this is the same spin. Is it clear? So they only overlap on the spin I. So they, the rest of the tensor product of these two operators will commute, because they don't have anything in common. Or to be precise, it's like in the tensor product of this operator, there is the identity in these places. So they will commute. But when they meet, they act like sigma x and sigma z. So they must have the same commutation relations. So they anti-commute. So this is checked. So they are indeed spins, spins 1/2. OK. So we would like to see, in terms of these new variables, what happens to our Hamiltonian. OK. So H, in terms of the mu variables and the coupling constants. OK. So I had minus j sigma I. OK. Then I have the term that is, so let me first write the second term, sigma z I, sigma z I plus 1. But this is simply what I called mu 1. OK. Oh, the sum is on m, of course. So I have mu 1 of m. Then I will have plus g. OK. Now, what is sigma x in terms of these variables. So we do this following trick. Let me write the string operator for a certain m. So this is, I have x up to a certain point. And then another string operator that is the same, but with one more side. So it writes up to m plus one. Let me take the product of these two. Okay, so I'm doing the product of mu 3m times mu 3m plus one. So they overlap everywhere but for the last site. And on the last site, this is just sigma x, right? Because mu 3 is the product of sigma x's. But where they overlap, they are the same operator. So I get the square of sigma x, the square of sigma x, and so on and so forth. So this is all the identity. And I'm left with the sigma x. So sigma x is the product of mu 3 m times mu 3 m plus 1. Let me put the hats. And now let me just pull j out. I can write this like 1 over g sigma sum of mu 1 plus sum over mu 3, okay, m plus 1. So where now we know that this mu 1 and mu 3 are spin operators. Well, what have we found? We found the Ising model again. So in part, to be precise, we have the Hamiltonian in the sigma variables and with the coupling constant G is equal to the Hamiltonian. Sorry, it's equal to G, the Hamiltonian in the variables mu and with the coupling constant 1 over G. So this is our duality. So a consequence of this is also that every eigenvalue ER of the first Hamiltonian, so in terms of the coupling constants G, is equal to G, the eigenvalue of the second Hamiltonian in terms of the coupling constants 1 over G. So in particular, this is true for the ground state. So the ground state for a certain particular value of G in the first model is equal to the ground state of the second model for the coupling constant 1 over G times G. And this is also true for the first excited state. So this means that the mass gap if the mass gap is zero, then G must be equal to 1 over G. Mass gap is just the difference between E1 and E0. But this is the condition that defines our critical point. When G goes to GC, our mass gap goes to 0. And this can happen only when G is equal to 1 over G, meaning that the critical value of G is 1. And for this particular value, this Hamiltonian becomes exactly this Hamiltonian. So the model is self-dual. So we have learned something important, that if the model is self-dual, then it must be critical. And this is a very powerful method to try to understand the phase diagram of models that we cannot solve. So here in this derivation, there is only one thing that I have swept under the carpet. So we have made an assumption, a hidden assumption. The hidden assumption is that this critical point is unique. So it could happen in principle that you have between the phase with the large g and the phase with the small g, do you have more than one critical point? So in this case, we cannot, this doesn't follow. So if it's unique, it must be at one. So somehow these arguments are very powerful, but then somehow you have to check. So, okay, I guess that the critical point is this one. Now, then you must have some other method to check. But because checking is less expensive computationally than looking for, especially when the model is not exactly solvable and you have to do numerical computation, having an ansatz that works is a very important thing. Okay. Yep.
Why does the zero imply that g is equal to 1 over g?
Oh, just because. Just because this, so we're saying that the difference between E1 G, this is equal to E0 G. And then we have that also this, that G E1 1 over G is equal to E1. 0, 1 over g, but we also have this, right? So, well, you see it the other way around, actually. So you see that because of this, so if you impose that g is equal to 1 over g, then the mass gap would be 0. So let me now go to the exact solution. So we want to find the exact spectrum of the model. Okay, so the essential ingredient is the so-called Jordan-Wigner transformation, which will map our spin 1/2 into spinless fermions. Also, this is a non-local mapping, and it works in this way. So first of all, let me remind you that sigma I plus minus is 1 over 2 sigma x I plus minus I sigma y. And let me define some operator CI and C dagger J in this way. So I have the product of all the spins just before I of sigma z. So I have this string of sigma z. And then on the I spin, I will put sigma plus. And then C dagger is the same object here, so the product of sigma z up to I, and then on I put sigma minus. Okay, so I have defined some operators in terms of my old variables. And the interesting thing is that they have fermionic commutation rules. So in particular, CI, C dagger, J is equal delta IJ, whereas CI and C dagger I, sorry, CI, CJ, C dagger I, C dagger J, anti-commute. So the inverse transformations of these are sigma plus I equal the product 1 minus 2 CC JJ CI, and sigma minus the same product. And here I have C dagger I, so 1 minus 2. Okay, so now we want to write our Hamiltonian in terms of these new variables C. So let's see how it works. So let me first compute C dagger C. Okay, so if you compute C dagger C, you see this first term, the product, is the same here. And these are products of Pauli operators, so they square to the identity. So this is just sigma minus I, sigma plus I. Okay, then of course, so I insert this, and what I will obtain is 1 over 4, and then we will have 2 minus 2 sigma z at I. So, which means that I can write sigma z as 1 minus 2 c dagger c. Okay, so I have derived sigma z in terms of C and C daggers, because then I want to plug it into my Hamiltonian. And then I should do the same for sigma x. So sigma x is sigma plus plus sigma minus. Okay, so but sigma plus is this and sigma minus is this. So they have this term in common. So this will be equal to this product of 1 minus 2 C dagger C, and then I have C plus C dagger. And of course, here there is J, and here there is I. Okay. So now, for convenience, I will make a rotation in my spins so that I will actually bring sigma Z into sigma X. So this is a rotation of 90 degrees around the y-axis, and this to minus sigma z. So this means that now sigma x is this operator, and sigma z is minus this operator. And then I plug them into my Hamiltonian. So we obtain the Hamiltonian in terms of these fermionic operators, which, if you put all the terms together, is h equal j, G minus 2G C dagger. So there is a sum over J sum over I C dagger C plus CI plus 1 CI plus C dagger I plus 1 CI plus CI plus 1 C dagger I plus incident I plus 1. Now notice that in this Hamiltonian doesn't conserve the number of fermions because, you know, I can destroy a pair of fermions here, I can create a pair of fermions, so the number of fermions is not conserved. Okay. So the next step, so this was the Jordan-Wigner transformation. So we have several transformations. The next step is to Fourier transform. So meaning that we go into momentum space, okay, space. So we define, so we have Cj is the, so sorry, Ck is the Fourier transform of Cj. So it's 1 over square root of n sum over all the Cj e to the minus I k Rj. Yep.
Do we work with finite chain? Yeah.
So this is a good question. So we of course are interested in the thermodynamic limit. So we will put a finite chain with the n, and then in order to see what happens at the thermodynamic limit, you take n to infinity.
There are some subtleties with Jordan-Wigner on finite chain.
Yes, so there is a, no, that's correct. So, so one thing that you could do is to put periodic boundary conditions.
But
then you have some boundary terms.
Yeah.
So, but the thermodynamics does not depend on the boundary terms. So whatever depends on the boundary terms is like 1 over n. So it's in the thermodynamic limit, these boundary terms will disappear. So it's true there are some subtleties about the boundary conditions, but they don't matter in the thermodynamic limit. Although for other considerations, then one has to put them back in. So remember also that the position Rj is simply J times A, where A is the lattice spacing. So in order to see how these terms behave, I need to invert my my transformation. So Cj is 1 over square root of n sum of k e to the minus I k Rj, that is Ja. Okay. So now we need to compute all these terms. I will show you one. So imagine I want to compute the term sum over I, C dagger I plus 1. Okay, so this is equal to 1 over n, sum over I, and then I have two sums over k, right? So I have k prime, then I have e to the I k I a. So this I is this index I, whereas this is the imaginary number. So maybe I should put L here. It's clearer. Then I have e to the I k prime L plus 1 times A. And then C dagger k prime. Well, now you see that the sum over L over e to the I k LA I k prime LA gives me a delta k prime. So this becomes 1 over n sum over just k because I use the delta. I am left with a e to the I k prime A. So this becomes e to the minus I k A, and then I have C dagger minus K. It's plus K prime. I think it's plus K prime.
Yeah.
Did you mean delta k, comma minus k prime?
Oh yeah. Thanks. Thank you. Okay, so you get the term like this, and then you have to do it for every term. And putting all the things together, you obtain that H is equal J sum over K to G minus cosine KA C dagger K C K plus E sine KA C dagger minus K K plus C minus K C K and minus G. Okay, so which is quadratic. However, we would like to do a last transformation. It's called Bogoliubov transformation. Just to find the new variables gamma k such that all the terms that change the number of fermions will vanish. So this can be done. So I will define gamma k equal to uk ck minus ivk c dagger minus k, where these numbers u and v square to the identity, and also u minus k equal uk and v minus k is equal minus vk. So the inverse of this transformation is ck equal uk gamma k plus ivk gamma dagger minus k. And now let me just define these numbers uk and vk in terms of some angle theta. So cosine theta k over 2 and sine of theta k over 2. So if you put the gamma variables using these numbers for uk and vk, and then we make the choice that the tangent of theta k is equal sine ka over g minus cosine ka, something that we can do, right? Because theta is some additional parameter. We can choose it as we like. So if you do this, our Hamiltonian becomes the sum over gamma dagger k, gamma k minus a constant, this multiplied by some excitation spectrum epsilon k that has this form, 2j 1 plus g squared minus 2g cosine k to 1 over 2. So what is the ground state now? So because all these numbers are positive, the ground state is obtained by the vacuum of these fermionic operators. So this is what minimizes the energy, because every time we create a fermion, we get this energy that is positive. So the vacuum of the fermions is the ground state of the model. And the first excited state is the minimum possible energy epsilon k, so the minimum over k. So this minimum is obtained by taking k equals 0 in particular here. So it means that my ground state energy is equal to 2g, the square root of the square of 1 minus g. So 2j, sorry. So the square root of a square is the absolute value, so this is 1 minus g. Okay. Sorry, this is the minimum energy. So this is also the mass gap. Okay, so we are done. This is the result that we wanted to find. So we see that for g equal 1, this becomes gapless. And we also see that nu times z, because now we want to look at that, the critical behavior. So when G is close to 1, we have some critical exponents z and nu, and their product is actually 1. So here is z and nu equal 1. Okay. So by doing perturbation theory, you should be able to find the same result also in perturbation theory. So this is an example in perturbation theory that works very well. Also, you don't need to do, right? So when we discussed perturbation theory, we thought we have to look at the small g case and the large g case. But we have also seen that the theory for small g maps into the theory for 1 over g, and vice versa. So in fact, to understand what is the behavior for the other limiting case, it's just the same with the inverse of the constant because of duality. So this simplifies the treatment as well. Questions?
Okay, how does this duality explain the correlation? How the correlation changes?
No, so the duality shows you that there is a point in which the system becomes gapless. So if the system becomes gapless, then the ground state is not analytic. And if it's not analytic, then yeah, you can have a jump in the correlation function. So what the duality doesn't tell you is what is the exact form of the correlation functions at the critical point where they are a power law. So you have something that it is xi minus xj to some power alpha. But so this can be computed from the exact solution, though in order to compute correlation functions, there's still some work to do. Although, I mean, now the model is solved. We have the exact spectrum, so we imagine that it should be possible. But so it's possible, it's still not trivial. One has to introduce Toeplitz determinants and other things. But if you compute the correlation functions, then at the critical point, you will find this power law. So the duality argument only helps you to locate the critical point. Other questions?